Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. On today's programme, will Germans get answers at a neo-Nazi trial next week?
I've been asked many times whether or not the terror group destroyed or hurt my trust in German democracy. No, they didn't. However, some part of the Secret Service has indeed destroyed my trust in democracy.
Also on Inside Europe, all hail the new king in the Netherlands, while Spanish royals stand red-faced in the dock. And is gang warfare out of control in Denmark? Stay tuned for those stories and more.
Lieve moeder, vandaag hebt u afstand gedaan van het koningschap. 33 bewogen en bevlogen jaren waar wij voor u intens, intens dankbaar zijn.
The new king of the Netherlands, Willem-Alexander, who ascended the throne on Tuesday following the abdication of his mother, Queen Beatrix. He thanked her for the 33 wonderful years of her reign in front of thousands of well-wishers, many decked out in orange, the colour of the Dutch royal family. Well, the celebrations and huge crowds left no doubt about the popularity of the monarchy in the Netherlands. The new king will have little political power, but the throne has enormous symbolic significance for the Dutch people. Jacques Arnold is with the Constitutional Monarchy Association, and he told me why he thinks kings and queens still have a relevant role to play, not just in the Netherlands, but also in other European countries.
The monarchy is very, very representative of the nation. It's fascinating to see the Dutch celebrating with the colour orange, with this drink that they produce on such special occasions. And it obviously was an emotional occasion and a terrific turnout.
Now, his mother, Queen Beatrix, stepped down, as did her mother, Queen Juliana. Why is abdication seen as a normal development in the Netherlands, whereas in other monarchies, for example, in the United Kingdom, it isn't?
It is a novel departure, but very Dutch.
But, I mean, in the UK, it seems that the Queen abdicating is simply not an option.
No, she has very, very clear views. Were she to be incapacitated, then it would be quite interesting to see what instructions she may have given for such an eventuality. But basically, in principle, the British royal family was scarred by the abdication crisis of 1938, as a result of which she came into the direct line to the throne. So there is, in Britain, that very, very much that angle.
If we look at other monarchies around Europe, for example, in Scandinavia, Belgium, Luxembourg, Liechtenstein, now, they haven't been immune from scrutiny over the years, and there has been the odd scandal or two, for example, you know, King Carl Gustav of Sweden allegedly having an affair. Are these thrones as safe as the Dutch one appears to be?
I would suspect they're very safe, but any monarch knows that part of the attraction of monarchy is for people to look up to almost to an ideal, but to an impartial arbiter in the affairs of the nation and the representative function. And it won't work so well if that becomes tarnished. They all know that, but equally monarchy is about a matter of human beings.
But, I mean, why is the monarchy still relevant today, especially given these times of austerity?
Well, monarchies don't need to be over the top. In fact, if you look back in history, the overtop ones, the great empires of Russia, Austria and Germany, they all smashed to pieces under the pressures of war, not least because of their being totally over the top. So the 21st century monarchs are very well aware of the balance they have to strike between, on the one hand, providing something magical, something for people to look up towards, against overdoing opulence and luxury. It's a very difficult balance, and by and large they achieve it in a way that suits their particular countries.
But, I mean, if a younger monarch like Willem-Alexander does adopt a more common touch, shall we say, then what makes someone like him different from us, and why should he be considered different from us?
because, again, he embodies the Dutch nation, a very historic country, and he is their long-stop arbiter in case democracy gets itself totally stalled and snarled up. It's incumbent upon him then to find a way through that the democratically elected representatives can work together.
Are we likely to see crowns changing hands in other European countries anytime soon?
Well, we are. People forget it, but King Albert II in Belgium will be 80 next year, so there may well be a succession there next few years. Of course, our own Queen just sails on so wonderfully at the age of, 87 now. We take her, in a way, for granted, but she is of a great age. The Danish Queen at 74, the Norwegian King at 77, they're all of them slowly going towards their twilight years and having heirs who are coming up noticeably with their own personalities, but ready to serve their countries.
And, of course, a lot of their wives are commoners, aren't they? They don't tend to intermarry anymore.
Yes, we're now into a generation when not only are they not marrying between royal families, but in most cases marrying commoners, and even then not necessarily from their own countries. Queen Maxima is an Argentine, for instance.
And that was Jacques Arnold from the Constitutional Monarchy Association. Well, the Spanish royal family can only dream about the sort of support and outpouring of affection that their Dutch cousins inspired this week. They've been plagued by a series of scandals, which have even led to calls for King Juan Carlos to abdicate. In this postcard from Madrid, Guy Hedgeco explains why.
Not so long ago, protests against Spain's monarchy, like this recent one, were extremely rare. But in the last couple of years, public opinion has started to turn against the royals, to the extent that they're facing their worst ever crisis. 5 or 10 years ago, it was common to hear Spaniards speak fondly about King Juan Carlos. "I'm not a monarchist," you might hear someone say, before they went on to sing his praises. These were the so-called Juan Carlistas, normally Spaniards with leftist or even republican tendencies, but who overlooked them because of their respect for this particular king. And that respect can be traced directly back to Juan Carlos's role in the country's transition to democracy in the late 70s and early 80s. He took the throne in 1975 as the anointed successor to right-wing dictator Francisco Franco, who had just died. But in 2011, the king's son-in-law, Iñaki Urdangarin, became embroiled in a corruption scandal. Investigators accused Urdangarin, a former professional handball player who is married to the king's daughter Cristina, of siphoning off millions of euros from a charity that he used to head. The case is still dragging on, tainting the monarchy's image as it does so. But even more worrying for the royal family, Urdangarin's wife, Cristina, has also been caught up in the case. In April, a judge summoned the princess to answer questions about her alleged role in the corruption scheme, but her appearance was delayed on appeal. On May the 20th, a judge will decide if she does become the first immediate member of the Spanish royal family to testify in court. But the king himself is also facing the opprobrium of his subjects. A year ago, it emerged he had broken his hip, having slipped while on an elephant hunting holiday in Botswana. Environmentalists were outraged that he had been shooting elephants. But many more people were angry that he was enjoying a lavish vacation at a time when there was talk of Spain's economy needing a sovereign bailout from the EU. And the economy, as much as the scandals themselves, has become the royal family's big problem. In a country where the jobless rate is 27%, people are particularly unforgiving of gaffes or a lack of integrity on the part of their leaders. Juan Carlos's reputation as a back-slapping bon viveur was fine when Spain was booming. During the slump, it doesn't go down so well. The media, which once treated him with reverence, has started to pry into his rather colourful private life. Republican demands for a major constitutional overhaul are now being taken more seriously. And even in the political mainstream, there have been calls for the 75-year-old Juan Carlos, who is in poor health, to abdicate and make way for his more popular son, Felipe. In 2015, the king will have spent 40 years on the throne, but it's looking less and less likely that he will still be Spain's monarch by then. And even if he is, the celebrations will probably be extremely muted. Guy Hedgeco, DW, Madrid.
It will be Germany's biggest trial in decades. On Monday, a court in Munich will open proceedings against a woman, Beate Zschäpe, and four men. They're accused of having been members or supporters of the National Socialist Underground. The NSU, a neo-Nazi terror cell, allegedly committed 10 murders, several bombings and a dozen bank robberies. Nine of the victims, killed over a period of 6 years, were small business owners of Turkish or Greek background. But the cases raise questions that go beyond the individual guilt of the accused. How could this neo-Nazi cell operate for so long? Were the authorities just unable to find them, or even unwilling? Michael Steininger has this report.
O Allah, segne unsere Brüder, Halit Yozgat.
A memorial service for Halit Yozgat. The 21-year-old son of Turkish immigrants was behind the counter of his father's small internet cafe in Kassel when two men entered just before 5 in the afternoon on April 6th in 2006. One of them pulled out a gun with a silencer and shot Halit in the head twice. The killers disappeared within seconds, undetected, but not before they had taken a picture of their victim, lying on the ground, covered in blood. I have confidence in the German police and in the courts, said Halit's father Ismail Yozgat at the memorial service in Kassel a few weeks ago. It is a surprising declaration of trust in the German authorities, given not only their complete failure to apprehend the murderers, but also the apparent reluctance of police and intelligence services to own up to their mistakes. The same pistol that was used on Halit Yozgat had killed 8 other Germans with migrant background before. Small business owners from Rostock by the Baltic Sea to Munich in Bavaria. But police and secret service failed to connect the dots. Instead, they suspected the victims to be involved with the Turkish mafia. A special police unit called Operation Bosphorus was created. The relatives of the dead fathers and sons suffered interrogations and accusations. The derogatory phrase of Dönermorde, kebab killings, was coined.
I've been asked many times whether or not the terror group destroyed or hurt my trust in German democracy. No, they didn't.
Mehmet Daimagüler is a lawyer representing two of the victims' families.
However, some part of the Secret Service has indeed destroyed my trust in democracy. They have really hurt my trust in this country and also have done harm to the reputation of our country.
20 years ago, the trio of Uwe Mundlos, Uwe Bernhard and Beate Zschäpe were well-known figures in the right-wing scene of Jena, a city in eastern Germany. When police tried to arrest them on suspicion of bomb-making in 1998, they went underground and stayed there, undetected, for 13 years. During this period, it appears, they murdered 10 people, they detonated 2 bombs in areas populated by migrants, and they robbed a dozen banks. On November 4th in 2011, one such bank robbery went wrong. Bernhard and Mundlos were cornered by police. They retreated into a camper van, set the vehicle on fire and killed themselves with a shotgun. A few hours later, their accomplice, Beate Zschäpe, turned herself in. Before she called the police, she blew up the house the trio had lived in and she posted copies of a DVD to several news organizations in Germany.
Unser rosa-roter Panther ist mal wieder arbeitslos und trottet durch die Straßen und denkt, was mache ich bloß, steht da...
The DVD contained a grisly video, a macabre montage of a clip from the Pink Panther movie interspersed with pictures of the victims, newspaper cuttings of the murders and, seen for the first time, the signature National Socialist Underground, NSU. An incredulous German public learned that not Turkish mafiosi, but a right-wing terrorist cell was responsible for the so-called kebab killings.
How could it be possible that our police, over 13 years, was not able to identify this group, which is and was responsible for 10 murders, 14 robberies and 2 bomb assaults?
Sebastian Edati is chairman of the parliamentary inquiry set up to investigate the role of police and secret service in these crimes.
The obvious failure of our security forces is at the least based on underestimating the threat of neo-Nazism in Germany, prejudiced investigation, and certainly a lot of miscommunication between different security institutions.
The federal structure of Germany's authorities clearly did not help. There are 16 state police forces, 16 state secret service bureaus, plus their national counterparts. But the lack of communication was only one problem. After the NSU's cover had been blown, police files were shredded. Pieces of evidence disappeared. Secret agents refused to turn up for questioning by the parliamentary inquiry. It transpired that neo-Nazi double agents had received large sums from intelligence officials in return for useless information. And when Khalid Yozgat was killed, an undercover agent of the Hesse Secret Service was present in the internet cafe, but allegedly did not notice anything and was there by sheer coincidence. So is it all a big cover-up? John Goetz is co-author of The Cell, Right-Wing Terrorism in Germany.
I've spent a year and a half going after and looking into the conspiracy theories, looking into the fact, was the German government involved in any of the murders? And in the beginning, it looked like there were some promising leads, and we've gone through every one of them and found none of them to hold water.
Still, many Germans are looking for answers, and they are looking to Munich. The trial there will aim to establish Beate Zschäpe's role in the NSU crimes, but its significance goes much further than one individual's possible guilt. John Goetz again.
The trial calls up the ghosts of a country that basically had a genetic defect from the very beginning having to deal with Nazis. And the fact that you have the security forces actively pursuing every Muslim they could who had some kind of radical ideology, and while closing their eyes about local neo-Nazis who were out killing Turks all over the country, invokes some of the deepest problems that this country has.
The German state is not in the dock in Munich. In fact, it is bringing the charges. And yet, there are fears it might not have done enough to keep the ghosts of Germany's darkest years in check. It is not going to be easy to allay these fears.
And that was Michael Steininger reporting there. I'm Helen Senian-Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. Local politicians in the Danish capital, Copenhagen, are warning that the city's gang warfare is out of control. They're alarmed at a recent surge in shootings and knife attacks. Controversially, a radical Muslim group is trying to recruit gang members to exchange crime for Islam. From Copenhagen, Malcolm Brabant reports.
Every day, Corinne Flederus lights candles and places them next to photographs of her 22-year-old son Timo, an innocent bystander shot dead by a notorious gangster.
Timo heard what he thought was fireworks, and he mentioned this to his best mate. And a split second later, he said, "I'm hit," and he said it twice. And then he closed his eyes.
Copenhagen's violent underbelly has been encapsulated in a new film called Northwest, which has been winning plaudits for its realistic portrayal of the city's battlegrounds. It was shot in the heart of Copenhagen's Badlands after the director, Michael Noah, spent 2 years winning the trust of genuine gangsters.
The facts are that there's a lot more guns now, so things have changed in the last 10 years. So if you are a criminal, it's probably more dangerous. There's a lot more blood on the street.
And here's the proof in Nobro, a Copenhagen district full of small ghettos. A crowd of residents has gathered around police chalk marks where 31 shell casings were discharged during an attack on a 19-year-old man. He was shot in the head and dispatched into a coma. Among the crowd, there's universal condemnation of gang activity.
You can sort of feel the tension in the street, you know, and that's not nice, especially because it's also during the daytime sometimes. And yeah, I wish it wouldn't be like that. Also because I'm afraid of these young kids who are also involved in it.
We have the right to live here as human beings, you know. We are all human and we have the same interests. We are here to live good, to make a better life. So they should stop shooting and live a good life.
Here in Norbro, second-generation immigrant gangs fight rivals such as the Hells Angels for the city's drug trade. Nina Thompson is one of Copenhagen's deputy mayors.
Here in Norbro, where I live, I think the gang problem is out of control. There have been a lot of shooting. And when it's not something, a shooting is not something that happens every third year, but it's something that happens every night, you get scared. I'm not that happy with the police right now because I know it's not under control, but I know they're doing their best.
Here at headquarters, the National Police say that 400 out of 1,600 known gangsters are behind bars. The Justice Minister insists that the police are doing a fantastic job in difficult circumstances. But there are some critics who say that so many police are being tasked with dealing with the gang wars that other crimes are being neglected. And there are some experts who say that for every gangster taken off the streets, there are two more who step forward to take his place. Keenly aware that many of Norbro's gang members have a Muslim background, a radical Islamic group called Hizbul Tahrir launched an attempt to lure them away from a life of crime and into religious devotion. The move has been condemned by critics as a cynical ploy to harness new members. Hizbul Tahrir's spokesman is Chadi Freji.
If I can turn some gang members and make them into good Muslims that behaves in accordance with the Islamic beliefs, which means they will be talking about against gangs and being involved in criminal activities, that should be something that we should celebrate.
Sitting in the segregated women's area, listening to Hizbul Tahrir's arguments, Anami Alislu, another of Copenhagen's deputy mayors.
Unfortunately, we know that they are taking advantage of this very bad situation right now and that they are trying to recruit to their organization because of the situation with the gang members right now.
At her home outside Copenhagen, bereaved Corinne Flederus believes that tough action is the only solution.
You don't want them to keep on doing what they do, ruining people's lives, killing innocent young men. They have to punish those gang members extremely hard.
Mrs. Flederus sits on a stone bench by the black granite heart that marks her son Timo's grave. With the authorities unable to contain the violence, there will continue to be a stream of mothers sharing her never-ending torment. Malcolm Brabant, DW, Copenhagen.
If you've reached a certain age, then this music might be familiar. It's from an album released 40 years ago this month. Now, it was a groundbreaking piece of work with the composer playing more than 20 instruments in a multi-layered recording. The album also launched Virgin Records, and this opening theme was used on the soundtrack to a famous American horror movie, which was also released in 1973. For this month's quiz, we want you to tell us the name of this album and the film. You can email your answers to us. Our address is europe@dw.de. Or write to us at Inside Europe, the English service, Deutsche Welle, Bonn, Germany. We have 5 prizes to give away and we'll announce the winners next month. Looking forward to hearing from you. This is Inside Europe and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. We'll be right back. This is Inside Europe and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. Over the next half hour, Cyprus banks on tourism to fill its empty coffers.
We are not a state in anarchy. The recent banking crisis that we went through hasn't made us any less hospitable, hasn't made us any less willing to welcome tourists from all over Europe and all over the world. This whole crisis has made us more determined to enhance and expand that tourism industry and give our guests the best experience that they can have.
Also coming up, foreign agents. Are we hearing the return of Cold War rhetoric in Russia? Latvians take to the streets to protest, well, about those streets. And sex workers in Turkey want to stay open for business. Stay tuned for those stories and more. In the years since Vladimir Putin returned to the Russian presidency, his government has unleashed a crackdown on civil society that is unprecedented in the country's post-Soviet history. That's according to a recent Human Rights Watch report. Our reporter Charles Maines in Moscow looks at the pressure facing Russia's non-governmental organizations, or NGOs, and finds Russia's courts are being used as the government's instrument of choice.
In Moscow's district court, justice is something seen rather than heard. Look around the courtroom and you'll notice hands cupped to ears, faces straining to read lips, bodies leaning tilt-shift forward, almost Michael Jackson style. For with a little luck, those in the audience here might almost make out what was happening in the trial against Russia's independent election monitoring watchdog, the organization Golos, if only the judge would speak up. Golos was facing charges it violated a new Russian law requiring what the government calls politically active NGOs that receive international funding to register as foreign agents. Golos has been at the forefront of organizations that rejects that term, arguing Russians equate foreign agents with espionage. Prosecutors targeted Golos for receiving $10,000 after the organization was awarded the Norwegian Helsinki Committee's prestigious Andrei Sakharov Freedom Prize last fall. No matter that Golos had declined the prize money, never mind it returned the funds in full after the Norwegians mistakenly transferred the cash prize, and forget that Golos hadn't accepted outside funding since the foreign agent law went into effect. The judge found the organization guilty as charged. Justice delivered, quickly and of course quietly. As word spread around the courtroom of a $10,000 fine, Golos director Lilia Shabanova just shook her head.
Ours is a difficult situation because if we refuse to register as foreign agents, the penalty doubles. And if we fail to pay that penalty, we'll be forced to stop our activities and a criminal case will be launched against me personally. We'll appeal today's decision, of course. But you see how things went here. Our only recourse may be to liquidate the organization.
Gunnar Eklof Slidell is deputy director of the Norwegian Helsinki Committee that awarded Golos the Sakharov Prize.
This is not acceptable in Europe or any other place to target human rights groups for doing what they should do, to scrutinize elections, other governmental policies. That's their job. This might be the beginning of very hard times for civil society organizations, and it will really hurt the image of Russia as a country who wants to go in a democratic direction.
To understand Golos's current troubles, it helps to look back to Russia's parliamentary elections in December 2011. Funded at the time by the US, European, and some Russian donors, Golos promoted fair elections by training citizen volunteers to serve as vote monitors. Many would end up documenting election fraud, casting an otherwise dominant victory by Vladimir Putin's ruling United Russia Party into doubt. Tens of thousands took the streets to protest what they saw as deeply flawed results. Since then, Putin's government has introduced a range of measures aimed at restoring order, or tightening the screws, as some Russians call it. Several opposition figures currently face indictments, new laws restrict freedom of assembly, and NGOs have faced increased pressure, accused of promoting Western interests with the aim of destabilizing the government. State media in particular has suggested the U.S. plays a sinister role in this effort. In the past few weeks, government agents have inspected hundreds of NGOs across the country in search of hidden links to America. The Center for the Support of Public Initiatives, a small think tank in the city of Kostroma, just a few hours from Moscow, is among those now in the government's crosshairs. According to the center's Nikolai Sorokin, the organization was targeted for inviting an American diplomat to take part in public roundtable discussions on U.S.-Russian relations. Sorokin says because of it, the Kostroma Center, like Golis, now faces charges it violated the foreign agents law. The organization will head to court later this month in hopes of avoiding crippling fines that may close its doors for good. Oleg Orlov of the human rights organization Memorial is also being challenged over the foreign agents law. Orlov says recent events remind him of old Soviet practices he witnessed, in which courts were used for show trials to discredit critics of state power.
It's a message to society, a message to all those people in society who actively protested after those outrageous election violations. And it says, it happened to Golos, and you could be next. There will be no monitoring elections, no protest meetings, no check on the power of the authorities. The message is, guys, stay home and keep quiet.
In his recent annual marathon press conference in Moscow, Russian President Vladimir Putin noted he welcomed the work of NGOs, saying they provided him with information over abuses in Russia. But the Russian leader rejected the notion that the foreign agents law and other measures were overly burdensome or hinted at Russia's darker Soviet past.
Russia has nothing in common with the repressions and gulags of the past, and I hope we never will again. Our society is different now, and we would never allow such a thing. But this doesn't mean that we shouldn't have order and discipline. It doesn't mean that all citizens shouldn't stand equal before the law.
That assertion will be put to the test as more Russian NGOs challenge the foreign agents law in court in the coming weeks. Should they find their fates similar to that of Golis, many have indicated they'll appeal to Europe's Human Rights Court for final review. Charles Maines, DW, Moscow.
As the holiday island of Cyprus finds itself in the eye of the Euro financial storm, the government in Nicosia is looking at how tourism can spearhead the country's efforts to restart its economy. The country is struggling to rally from the austerity inflicted by an international financial bailout last month, which saw the closure of its second biggest bank and a massive reduction in the offshore financial sector. Nathan Morley reports from Nicosia.
Cyprus's banking sector has been left in tatters by a raid on deposits, and the president addressed the nation earlier this week to outline the urgent measures that have to be taken to kickstart the economy. For years, Cyprus has profited from its two major industries, finance and tourism. But with its banks crippled and its pivotal financial service sector being dismembered, all hopes are now pinned on the holiday trade to plug the gap. The Cypriot Minister of Tourism is George Lakotripis.
So we are developing the tourism sector both in terms of quantity and quality so that we can enhance and increase our per capita income. I don't expect it will close the entire gap, but it would take us a long way to recovery much sooner than anticipated.
It's been a blistering month for Cyprus, but a rare piece of good news came from Europe's largest tour operator. TUI Travel Deputy Chief Executive Johan Lundgren flew to Cyprus last week to send the message that tourists need Cyprus and Cyprus needs tourism.
We got to remember that tourism is an old industry in here. We've been working together with our partners here and the island for up to 50 years as well. We're stable, we're reliable, We are there to support in difficult times as well, in positive times as well. So I think that there is absolutely everything to be hopeful for and to see this as an opportunity that tourism will remain and perhaps can become even more the lifeblood of the Cypriotic economy.
In an attempt to counter the potential fallout from weeks of negative foreign press headlines, the whole nation appears to be rallying around the tourist product. The council at the holiday resort of Ayia Napa even commissioned a video which they posted on YouTube to assure people that in Cyprus, it's business as usual.
No, I haven't had any problems getting any cash out or anything, so it's just kind of, they're making it worse than it is, and it's wonderful here, so.
No, everything seems fine, everything's just as normal, just as I remember it.
No, I mean, we can take money out of the ATMs, no problem, everything's working fine, all the services are there, you know, everything you want is there, there's no... No, this is absolutely not. No.
Yes, no problems whatsoever. No.
We're coming back. Certainly, we will be.
The head of the Ayia Napa Tourism Committee is Lakis Avramidis.
I don't know why people are in Europe, they think that there's no food available in Cyprus, that we are starving here, that if they come here, they will not have food or service in the hotels, that they cannot use their credit cards, that they have to bring cash with them and have to be very careful for the exchange. All these things that are going around in the media or in public opinion definitely affected the bookings that they seem to be blocked now.
The Minister of Tourism says that Cypriots have been deeply shaken by the image portrayed in the media that Cyprus is on the brink of disaster.
We are not a state in anarchy. Right, the recent banking crisis that we went through hasn't made us any less hospitable, hasn't made us any less willing to welcome the tourists from all over Europe and all over the world. This whole crisis has made us more determined to enhance and expand that tourism industry and give our guests the best experience that they can have.
Many Cypriots have expressed anger at Germany and the Troika's demands. The German media have given extensive coverage to the animosity towards Berlin on the streets of Nicosia. Chancellor Angela Merkel bears most of the hostility, with one banner strapped to a railing near Parliament depicting Mrs. Merkel as Adolf Hitler. Johan Lundgren from TUI doubts that such scenes will make much impact on German tourists, though.
But we do believe that there is an opportunity in Germany in the midterm and long term as well to grow the presence over here as well. That's the feedback we're getting as well from the customers in that market, that yes, there has been a dip, there has been a concern about it, but it's not as dramatic as one might think.
Revenue from tourism last year showed an increase of 10.2%. But whether this sector has the ability to make dramatic growth in the coming months still remains to be seen. For now, Cypriots are pinning their hopes on foreigners flocking to the island this summer, which they insist is still open for business. Nathan Morley, DW, Nicosia.
Well, just across the Mediterranean from Cyprus, in Turkey, a storm is brewing over state-run brothels. They've existed there since before the creation of the secular state in Turkey nearly 90 years ago. But many different parts of society are now against the brothels, and the Islamic-influenced AK governing party has started closing some of them down. That's prompted a storm of protests from sex workers who rely on the brothels for their livelihoods. Dorian Jones has more from Istanbul.
Doğru diyorsunuz. Nasıl biz erkeklerin ihtiyacını düşündüysek.
In Taksim Square, in the heart of Istanbul, Hayrettin Bulan reads a declaration calling for male brothels. The call is being made by the anti-poverty group Sefkat Dere. The group is fighting for an end to state-run brothels. Bulan says their radical move comes out of frustration.
Buradaki insan hakları ihlalini görmeden, anlamadan, bir hareket etmeden...
The government is basically protecting sex slavery using legal grounds to do so. They say men need sex and they need to go to brothels. But on the other hand, they are not accepting the principles of gender equality. When we tell them, what if women need sex too and demand such a place? Then you should open male brothels to meet this demand. If you think there is a need, then think of women's needs and open male brothels.
This isn't just a media stunt. Sefkat Dere is no stranger to controversy and to matching its words with action. Last year, it organized shooting classes for female victims of domestic violence, as well as helping them apply for firearm licenses. Bulan of Sevcut says they've already petitioned Parliament and the Ministry of the Interior under legal principles of equality for the opening of male brothels, and warns if their request is rejected, they'll open a case at the European Court of Human Rights.
Türkiye mahkum edilecek. Çünkü Türkiye erkek genel evi açacağını zannetmiyoruz. Yetkileri hiçbir şekilde aşmaz.
We don't think Turkey will open male brothels. But with the fines from the European Court for violating gender equality, such rulings would show Turkish hypocrisy to the outside world. And this compensation money will be used to fund women seeking a life outside of prostitution.
One of the women supporting the campaign is former sex worker Ayşe Tukucu. She managed to successfully build a life for herself after working in state-controlled brothels. Something she says is extremely difficult.
Bugünkü eylemde biz şunu dile getirdik. Ben Ayşe Tükürükçü olarak eski genel evinde.
I worked in brothels for 20 years until I left in 1996 by marrying. I know very well the torture, the violence, drug use and how the state is an accomplice in brothels because I worked in 7 brothels across Turkey. Women are seen as worthless in these places, and it's so difficult to get another job once you've worked there. If selling women is this easy, then open a male brothel, as in a population of 70 million, there are more than 30 million women.
The opening of male brothels is unlikely, with the ruling Islamic AK party being far from enthusiastic over the state running brothels anyway. Under its decade-long rule, the number of brothels has nearly halved to the current 56. Sex workers are protesting at the temporary closure of the historical Karakur State Brothel in central Istanbul. Police say the Karakur brothel was shut for violating rules controlling it. But this sex worker, who did not want to give her name, claims the closure is part of systematic efforts to end state brothels entirely, a policy she claims will endanger women.
Today on this street, 6 brothels are closing. There are 100,000 women working on the street undocumented. 40,000 of them applied to brothels to work. If this continues, this will result in women going to the streets without any control or protection and without any health measures. We don't have a choice. We have to do this job in order to continue living.
The whole controversy over state brothels seems to have put the government between a rock and a hard place. While it's curtailing state brothels, it appears reluctant to end what has existed for more than a century, probably wary of being accused of implementing a religious agenda. But as long as there are state brothels for men, the call for brothels for women seems set to grow too. And this call for male brothels has made the discussion whether the state should run brothels even more heated. Dorian Jones, Deutsche Welle Radio, Istanbul.
Now, if you remember the good old days when shortwave radio dominated the international airwaves, then this audio clip might sound familiar. It's from Beethoven's opera Fidelio, and it was the interval signal that Deutsche Welle used to air before each broadcast. It's now history, but this week Deutsche Welle is celebrating that history because it's 60 years since DW began broadcasting. Well, there isn't much shortwave left, but there's plenty of TV and online on offer, as well, of course, as rebroadcast programmes like this one. With me in the studio is my colleague Bernd Riegert. Bernd hasn't been around for 60 years, but he has been at Deutsche Welle for over 2 decades. And in that time, he's worked as Washington and Brussels correspondent and then as head of the European desk. Bernd, first of all, what's the most memorable story you've covered for Deutsche Welle?
Well, I guess the most memorable was, of course, 9/11 in Washington, because we were inside the story when the story developed. You were part of the story reporting in Washington. That was, of course, the story of a lifetime, I would say. But the most impact on me, there was another more little and tiny story when I covered the 50th anniversary of the liberation of the concentration camps in Germany back in 1995. I visited a Jewish lady in her little flat in the northern part of Germany, in a little tiny village, and she told me how she survived the concentration camp of Bergen-Belsen. And that was a story, you know, very, very touchy and very personal. And that, I would say, was the best story I ever made for Deutsche Welle.
I mean, you've worked on both sides of the Atlantic. What are the differences between reporting in the US compared to here in Europe?
I would say in the United States, people are much more open working with journalists, you know, normal people on the street. You can just ask them, tell me your story, and they do. Back in Europe, people are more closed up and say, who are you? What are you doing that for? On the other hand, politicians in Washington have more restrictions and they wouldn't talk to foreign media as easily as politicians do here in Germany or in Europe. So in a commissioner, for example, in the European Union, is much more accessible than a senator in the United States. That's easier. But the ordinary people are much more open in the United States, and they are better hosts than the Europeans, I guess.
Well, I mean, in the 20-odd years that you've worked for Deutsche Welle, we've had some pretty big developments here in Europe. We've had the fall of the wall, German unification, revolutions, wars, and now, of course, the financial crisis. What, for you, is the most challenging aspect of reporting European affairs?
Europe is very complex, and Europe is so complex that it's very difficult to put that in a report, because there's never black and white in the European Union. It's always shades of grey. And so it's very difficult to explain to people how the European Union works and how decisions are made. And I would say the financial crisis is still the most challenging story, because it's still going on and are people fed up with it, but we have to explain it every day again and again. That's very difficult, I guess.
I mean, over the years, the way we go about getting the news has changed radically because of technology, the internet, we have better equipment and so on. How have you seen the craft of news gathering change in your time?
I like the word craft. When I started here in Deutsche Welle, we still had mechanical typewriters we were typing on, you know, and we said hooray when the first fax machine arrived. Hard to believe, but that was the time. And then internet came in the late 90s, and of course everything has changed with the internet. Now, to access information from all over the world is very easy, but on the other hand, you have this overflow and overload of information, and you don't have the time to do the gatekeeping and to change and sort all this information. And when I think back, the audio equipment to do a live story in the 1990s was still in a truck. Now it's in a laptop or even in a smartphone. So technically wise, a lot has changed.
And that was my colleague Bernd Riegert. And if you'd like to know more about Deutsche Welle's 60th birthday celebrations or catch up with our news coverage and programs in 30 languages, go to our website. That's dw.de. I'm Helen Sinian-Bonn and you're listening to Inside Europe. Around half of all roads in Latvia are in a woeful condition, full of potholes and uneven surfaces because of insufficient funding and poor construction work. At the same time, the number of cars keeps increasing. According to a recent report by the World Economic Forum, Latvia is ranked 98th among 140 countries for road quality. The bad roads have been a thorny issue for years, and many Latvians are up in arms about it. The situation is particularly acute in rural areas, where road conditions have become dangerous for drivers. As Gerets Gelzers reports from Riga, Latvians are left with no choice but to take to the streets in protest.
Around 50 people cheer as they stage a peaceful protest beside the government building in Riga at the beginning of April. The demonstrators have arrived from Vatsbybarg, a village of just 500 people in the eastern region of the country. Vatsbybarg. Almost all the slogans on the posters include the word pothole and refer to the main road which leads to the village of Vatpeybalg. 37-year-old lawyer Martis Luočmelis is organizing the protest. He says that this potholed road hasn't been reconstructed for almost 30 years.
The roadway poses a threat to people today, tonight, and tomorrow, and it will continue to do so until road repairs are carried out. We're calling for a state of emergency to be declared in the district because this threat must be averted without delay. The government must apply technology to solve this problem, and it must find the political will to do something for local residents.
Luočmelis has launched an online campaign, but it was his 10-year-old daughter, Loreta, who really got the wheels turning. Back in March, she sent a letter to the Prime Minister, Valdis Dombrovskis, asking him to fix the awful road which her family has to use every day. Loreta says that she advised the politician to spare his car and to visit the village by helicopter.
I was going on the bus to a Latvian language competition in a nearby village when the bus hit a pothole or a bump on the road. The bus jumped about terribly. I fell out of my seat and bruised myself. There's also a pothole on the way to music school. I have to fasten the seatbelt and hold on tightly, because otherwise I might fall out of my seat.
The regional road which connects the cities of Cēsis and Maduon and cuts through Vatpeybalg is indeed in dire condition. According to the local municipality, more than 20 car accidents have occurred and 6 people have been injured during the last 7 months. But the fact is that most of the roads in Latvia, the third poorest member state of the EU, are in a bad state and require urgent reconstruction. The bad roads particularly affect the rural population, which accounts for about 50% of Latvia. But the funding for the industry is just not there, says Janis Lange. He's from Latvian State Roads, a company responsible for roads in the country.
It's very important that such initiatives are not organized every now and again, as they have to be continuous. We're interested to see that people are now stepping up demand for high-quality roads and keeping up the pressure on our politicians.
Lang explains that the situation in Vatpeybalg is not unique because around 2,000 kilometers of regional roads need to be repaired throughout the country. This year's road budget is close to 160 million lats, or more than 200 million euros, just half of the sum needed. Lange adds that the government should restore a special road fund which was stopped nearly 10 years ago. Otherwise, the roads will continue to deteriorate. But not everyone thinks that the problem is just about lack of funding. Paul Stimrods is a driver and journalist working for a TV program on road safety. He says that quite often there is a special relationship between road construction companies and officials. For instance, in order to win government road contracts for roadworks, some companies offer lower prices than their rivals and use poor quality materials instead of the required ones.
Basically, there's a mob of men who have graduated from a technical university more or less at the same time. They share competitions for the road construction contracts among themselves, and they also carry out inspections. They're in close contact with each other, and that's why there will never be a good result.
But corruption is not the only problem. It is also about political will and where the funding is directed. At the moment, the government mostly spends on social matters, such as measures to improve demographic situation, and the road infrastructure is not a priority. Janis Lange maintains that the quality of road construction is good in Latvia and that the only problem, really, is insufficient funding. In the meantime, his company Latvian State Roads is about to start patching up the road in Vatpeybalg. The company initially planned to start full reconstruction of the road in 2015, but because of the protests, the company has now pledged to repair the road within the year. But even this promise is not enough for Martis Luočmelis and his daughter Loreta, who are forced to maneuver between the deep potholes in their car every day. They hope that their protests will make politicians sit up and think, instead of burying their heads in the sand like ostriches. Jadars Džēlzis, DW, Riga.
And thanks for joining us this week. I hope you enjoyed the program. It was produced with help from Emma Wallace and sound engineer Christoph Grofer. I'm Helen Sini. Join me at the same time next week. Inside Europe comes to you from Deutsche Welle in Bonn.